This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
What's up?
Hello.
Yo.
This might be the most normal episode we've had in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
It's probably right. Yeah.
I feel like one of us has been out for a while.
Yeah. And like the one time we were all together that wasn't the mega episode was just like 30 minutes about talking about nothing. So
but yeah, the one where I had to drop off.
Yeah, that one.
Okay. So. Well, the mega episode came out. I thought it came out good.
I loved that. It was so much fun.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Plus one. Well, today on the podcast, we are introducing Kevin Murphy. Kevin is a developer at the NAR company. He's also got several RailsConf talks that are really good and you should check out. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, everyone.
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about the downsides of focusing on code coverage. Dry performance is a singular measure of good code, quote unquote, which I'm very interested in because I've had this conversation recently and it's a tricky thing, right? Like, how do we evaluate whether our developers are doing their jobs or not? And I think a lot of business people are like, oh, well, we'll just count the lines of code they did. And I've heard developers like, well, if we focus on code coverage, and that means that we're doing our jobs, right? Like, you don't submit code, you're writing tests and all this other stuff. Like, it's just a mess, honestly. So I'm hoping you can give us some good tips about this.
Yeah, so unfortunately, if I did have the answer for definitively what to find quality code, I'd probably be better off in my career and life in general. But I do think any sort of metric that you have or track is likely to get gamed or will maybe put to the forefront in lieu of other things. And the unfortunate reality is that like some of these things are like easy to explain rules to a lot of people and easy to comprehend for a lot of people. And therefore, it can be easy to glom on of like, oh, if I do these things, then we're doing things correct. And like a lot of the time, you're probably right. But the hard part is like the world has a lot of nuance in it. So knowing when to apply certain things and when to, care is a strong word, but when to value certain things at certain times is hard to do, quite frankly. I'm not saying I have the answers either, but I think it's important to consider it as like a holistic approach as opposed to like an absolutist, no, we always do this for this reason.
That makes sense. Let's talk about code coverage first. I am not a fan of the code coverage metric. I think there's value in it to a degree, but not if it's like a measurement of whether you're doing your job or not. I think SimpleCov is good for giving you like a holistic idea of, you know, where your application has tests and where it doesn't, but I don't think it's good to try to satisfy it 100% because it ends up trying to force you to write tests for things that you shouldn't test. My opinion.
Yeah. So code coverage is tough because, again, it's easy like, oh, make the number go bigger and that's better. But is there value in the things that you're doing? That's a bigger question mark. So if you like have a Rails app just out of the box and you just do the full batteries included, everything you need in Rails, and you're not using Action Cable, well, Rails puts together, you know, an Action Cable base class that's in your application that's going to be untested according to SimpleCov. So should you spend the time to either test something you're not using or rip it out? You could, but do you care? I don't know. Is there business value in doing that? Like, is that beneficial to the app or whoever's using it? I can't make that call, but purely looking at SimpleCov and going, not tested bad, doesn't tell you the whole story. I think coverage gives you a really good signal, either in terms of generally tracking over time health of the system, but it's not a holistic measure.
That's like a very good point. And it is a good signal because like on the other side of it, there's like times when I've run SimpleCov that it's told me that like, oh, this little bit of code, it's tested and it's not really tested. It was just called by some other code. So, I mean, it's tested in the sense that it didn't blow up, but I never wrote any kind of like specs for an actual method or like a chunk of code.
Yeah. So the other, this is going to be a purposely inflammatory statement, but code coverage can also lie to you. There are lots of ways to measure coverage. In Ruby, there are four in Ruby's coverage module itself. And what SimpleCov out of the box will do, and a lot of other tools will do line coverage, right? Which is just how many lines were executed as this code was run. And if you have any lines in your application that have a ternary statement, you have no guarantee that all of the code paths of your application have been tested just by that line getting hit, just by that measure of like, it's like the easiest example just to point to. It's like a ternary statement will have two branches of code on a single line. And SimpleGov is going to tell you, yep, that line's covered.
Yeah. And I think where it gets even trickier is when someone is basing that metric on whether or not you're doing your job. I think that's where it gets bad. Because yeah, like you said earlier, if it's measured, it can be gamed. So it also kind of at that point definitely incentivizes you to write crappy tests. I don't think the application really gains anything from it. If anything, I think you're wasting time and probably making your tests slower and unmaintainable.
So I love tests. I can't do my job without tests, and I can't do my job confidently without tests. But tests are code just like application code, and all code has a cost. And if we're writing tests and we're writing application code, we are bearing some carrying cost to maintain those over time. So there's like a total cost of ownership conversation needs to happen here. So for tests, like if you have a CI system or like every time you run, like they're going to run every single time. So are they doing their job every single time that they run? I hope so. Depending on what is their job. Is this important to the regression suite? Was it important when we wrote the feature, but now we don't need it now? That's a hard question to have. And also test code needs to be updated. Sometimes you might update your version of Ruby that might have some changes to it that you need to keep up to date with. You might have test gems that need to get updated and you might have changed your tests. And I'm not saying that's bad or you don't need to do that. You should, but there are costs associated with keeping that code around. And so you need to make sure that it's carrying its weight.
Definitely. So what are some other downsides of focusing on code coverage?
Well, so I think there's a two sides of this. Of like, it can be demoralizing, particularly if you're in an app that has like those checks, like I think Coveralls will do this, that says after every PR, like this decreased the code coverage by 0.4% or increased coverage by whatever. Again, just looking at that as a number, like, so if I wrote a ton of documentation and that documentation was like yard docs and whatnot, and if coverage, if whatever coverage system you were including didn't exclude those, which in fairness, line coverage would, but bear with me. You'd submit a PR and you'd see coverage went down a bunch. You're like, oh, well, that's bad. Well, no, it's not bad. Like I did something incredibly important. I added a bunch of documentation. So if you're using that in isolation, it'd be tough to tell as pure quality metric, was this thing good or bad compared to what I did? So if you have things that like set floors where coverage can't go underneath, I mean, that can be fine if you're at a particular level. It's not something I do in my applications, and that's fine. It can be helpful when you're starting off if you have an incredibly low number to see rapid velocity of it increasing. Hey, we went from 0% to 20%. That's amazing. We added a bunch of feature specs or high-level acceptance tests, and we hit a bunch of paths in the application. That's great. It can help tell a story based on what the goal is that you're trying to achieve. But purely from like a myopic change to change consideration, I personally don't see a lot of value in it with that by itself.
And I'm curious, how can focusing on code coverage be like a bad thing? Because I think there is obviously some value in it, like you just said, but when is it too much?
I don't think there's like a number, right? It was like, oh, if you get to 95%, don't care anymore. Or is it 83%? Right. Is it 97? I don't know. But I think if you take that number and take it in context with how the dev team has confidence in making changes in the application and how the team of, whether it be the larger business team or users, depending on what the application is, receive those changes, that in concert with coverage can help give you some better signal. But looking at it just purely as a number that needs to get driven up, why is really my main question, right? What value is that serving? Well, it was 86 right. And now it's 87, so it's better.
I'm curious, what are some metrics that you think are good to like track like that? Because there's not many in my mind that I can think of. Oh yeah, that's a great metric to show how our developers are doing outside of, you know, if you're working on like sprints and you have like points and you can, you know, check the points for a developer and be like, hey, this is our goal, your goal for this quarter, whatever, is to hit this amount of points and et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't hit those points, then it's okay because there might've been extenuating circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. But what are some other good things that you can track that will provide value for your team?
That is a very good question. I will answer it by saying it depends, but it depends based on what goals you're actually looking to accomplish. If you're an early stage company and you have a very hard cliff, quite frankly, there are a lot of like very real conversations that have to happen about, yeah, like we're going to maybe cut some corners here and not apply certain design patterns and not write tests in certain ways. Because if we don't, and then we don't land that big client, we don't have any money and we don't exist as a company anymore. And that is perhaps a hyperbolic, but also realistic situation in sometimes, which is a lot of words to not answer your question, but to go back to what is it that you're trying to accomplish and then building metrics based off of that.
Yeah, I accept that. It's hard, especially if you don't have someone who's done this before. Maybe if your team is like younger, it's hard, especially if your management as well, they don't have a good way of measuring your team. And then they start focusing on these kind of presentational kind of aspects of it. It's difficult.
Do you think that stuff happens as a symptom of like maybe the business side doesn't trust the technical development side in the company and stuff?
I don't know. I mean, because I think it can go the other way too, of right, like we could pull out any number of numbers on our quote unquote tactical side if we're going to play size that make us look good, but may or may not actually be good. Again, we can have 100% test coverage and people can go like, oh, that seems good, but we got bugs all over the place, but we're not going to talk about that because we're going to put a chart that says 100%. And I mean, trust goes both ways and that's, you know, a whole other conversation, but I guess, what are you looking to get at there?
I feel like there's been times in the past where we'd have managers or whatever tracking velocity and, you know, being kind of aggressive about those things or like, and I guess too, like we're talking a lot about coverage with tests and things, but also like same kind of stuff applies with code climate checking for like complexity of methods or repeated lines of code that are, you know, you could make them dry. And I feel like I've seen this happen where the metrics can kind of like, that becomes something that the managers or business side of things are looking at. Oh, the coverage is going down or whatever. Like we assume that you're not doing your job as well. And they don't really understand the context of it because they're just like, oh, it's a number and it's going in the wrong direction. It's probably a bad thing. And I felt like that is something I've experienced or whatever. And I've always kind of like had a negative feeling towards a lot of these metrics because there is so much nuance to the meaning of them and the value that you can get out of it and all that, that it is a part of why I feel like there's tension with code coverage and these metrics and everything.
One thing that did come to mind as something that I think can be a helpful metric, but also a blameless one without more information is, you had mentioned complexity and that led me to think of churn. How often are we touching a particular piece of code such that it needs to change frequently? And that doesn't mean that it's poorly written code. It could mean that perhaps there's a different abstraction that we need to introduce. It could mean that the actual structure and design of it needs to change. It could also mean that what we want the application to do is changing every week. And that's also a helpful signal to get the larger team involved and go, hey, everyone, turns out every 3 weeks we change what the text says on the footer of the application. Like, is that good? Are we okay with that? Like, this is changing a lot. Is it for a valid reason? And it could be, yeah, it's totally fine. It's totally cool. But it can be something to have a good sense of. And all that being said, I don't have tools that do that in an automated fashion. So I don't have a good dashboard of, oh, where's our highest churn? But I do sort of, at least in my work, I back that out with like, how often are we getting tickets or feature requests or bugs that relate to certain areas and then try to root cause from there of, is this because we should rewrite this section, not application? Is it because we, you know, miss some sort of abstraction? Is it because we don't have a great understanding of what this actually does and we wrote something that maybe is missing the mark and we need to circle back and have a broader discussion than just fixing this one small bug?
Yeah, I think that leads to, you know, questions of like, if you're getting requirements into like, how well did those get thought out before they got to the development team? And you can notice a lot of that stuff. Or if it's repeated bugs in whatever feature, then you're like, okay, we probably need to spend some more time and just check everything here, make sure we designed it the way it should be done. Because especially you have all these times too where your sales team could go sell some feature you don't actually support. And then they're like adding all these requests for whatever. And you're like, hold on a second. Like, well, how come nobody told us about this ahead of time? And, you know, it is interesting because this is sort of the like intersection of so many parts of a company where you're trying to keep track of all these things. And it is very meta in a way where you're like trying to get a grasp of how well is the company communicating internally almost with these metrics and their numbers, which are very easily misunderstood. But I really like the idea of keeping an eye on, and I feel like I intuit this on a lot of my projects, but keeping an eye on the churn, the amount of changes you do to a certain area. And that is, I think, really interesting because that is a sign that, yeah, either the business requirements are changing very often on there, or there could be problems with the design in it. And that is a good measurement of that. And maybe you could do something with like your Git history and see like this file has changed 10,000 times versus the other ones, which are like 100. And you could point out some of that maybe. That's kind of cool. I don't know of any tools that really do that.
Yeah, I don't have any offhand that I reached for. I'm pretty sure they exist, but I'm going to do them all a disservice and say I apologize for not being able to reference them.
I think a tractor will do it from Julian Rubish, and I think Ruby Critic might as well, but don't fact check me. I wanted to go back to something you kind of said earlier, which I think should be underscored, that it comes down to what the business values. If longevity is like the goal, then they're probably going to want you focusing more on writing clean, maintainable code and, you know, taking a long time to like get these features right and like this and that. But if the company is like a startup and they're trying to move quickly, then they may not care if you're writing tests. They want you to move as quickly as possible. And at the end of the day, you have to optimize for what the business is wanting you to do.
With the caveat that you need to know when is appropriate to push back and advocate for certain things, because you can propose an additional value that would have to the organization that folks may not even be aware of.
Absolutely.
So like a Rails upgrade is never going to be on anyone's radar for like, oh man, it's got all these whiz bang Rails 7 features in, because then our note-taking app will be that much better. But we can still sell that as health and stability of the application. And also, oh, you do have this feature in the roadmap that like may be able to pull in the new database switching functionality if we upgrade, da 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 da. You've got to have an eye on knowing how to advocate for things that are important for the longevity of the team from your perspective, as well as taking in their perspective as well. And to me, it's all about communication and shared understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so along with code coverage, I mean, you have this other thing of like, how dry is our code base? How important is it that your code base is super dry? Because I have opinions that are mainly reinforced by working with Nate Hopkins about this, but I'm curious what your thoughts on this are.
So maybe surprised to hear it depends. Dry code can be great. We only have to write something once, then we can use it 7 other places. That's great. It's also, again, going back to like, it's an easy rule to kind of say out loud. And therefore, it's also like, can be easy to point out. There was actually a thread on Twitter yesterday as of this recording about dry code. And Beth, who's at Beth Codes on Twitter, mentioned something to the effect of, and I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing here, of the importance is not how many times you write it, but when you have to change it, how many places you have to change it. So if you have to copy and paste something 27 times, and again, that's hyperbolic, maybe that's not a problem. But when something changes, then you have to change it in 27 places, then that's a big problem. Because if you get to 26 of them and you forget the 27th one, you've got yourself a situation. Giving yourself the flexibility to make changes and not make changes as are dictated by the needs of the system, I think is the key thing to think about with dry code. So there are certain things that just cannot and should not change, right? Like how we calculate sales tax should not change anywhere else in the application. So let's have one place to do that. Go for it. How we make a new user in our tests, things like factories and fixtures can help you with that. Do you need to use only that one thing every single time? No. Do you only need to have that in one line in your spec file or test file? I would advocate not, so that you can actually like read your individual test and not know like, yeah, that user's actually created 400 lines above in the test file, but I only wrote it once. When I'm reading the test, I have no idea where it came from.
Yeah, a very loose rule that I use is kind of like a rule of three. If I see it 3 times, the 3rd time is when it's time to go ahead and abstract it. And if I see it 2 times, it's going to depend on how big it is or how much churn is around that code. At that point, I might just put like a comment or like a to-do or something like, hey, like this is duplicated from this place. It would be great if when we have time that we can go back and fix this. But when I see it 3 times, I think that's generally where I'm like, okay, it's time to go ahead and abstract this.
Yep. So some people talk about writing wet code, which is write everything twice. Conveniently, that also works for write everything thrice. So you can choose your own number to add in there of how many times. Sandy Metz talks about this and does it much better than I ever could, as with a lot of other things, about duplication being cheaper than the raw abstraction. If you abstract something away in service of writing dry code, you may find yourself from just inertia or lack of momentum, like locked into a certain way that the code is structured that's harder to back out of. And now when you have to make future changes, if you've learned something else that then would radically change your design, you might be put in an unfortunate situation where now you have a really difficult problem to solve that would have been easier if you hadn't put that code together. And you did the best you could at the time with the information you had, but things change. And sometimes we're asked to predict the future. And I'm not very good at predicting the future, because if I was, I would just pick lottery numbers and, you know, I'd be doing something radically different. But you make calculated bets, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. But for me, you know, with writing dry code or not writing dry code, it's about how much flexibility do I need to afford myself in this design, or how much rigidity do I need to have, and how much do I know, and what am I likely to learn in the future such that I maintain that flexibility?
I like that a lot. It's hard. Like you keep saying, it depends. It always depends.
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, honeybadger.io. One of the things that's really tricky about error monitoring is that when you get an error, it could have come from anywhere. It could have come from a background job or a user doing some weird thing. They have JavaScript turned off. You never know. And so you might get these stack traces, but you might not know how to debug them. And that is really a pain in the butt. So Honeybadger has a really cool feature called Breadcrumbs. And you can integrate their client-side and server-side libraries so that you can track what was going on when an error occurred. So for example, you have a front end, it has a button to go sign up, your user clicks that and it makes a post request to your API, and your API has a failure response, and then your JavaScript has an error because, well, something went wrong on the back end. Well, what's really cool is that you're able to track all of that with Honeybadger and see the steps that actually happened in the browser and the server side. So you can go replicate those steps and try it yourself and actually replicate those errors and actually solve the bugs. And that is super cool, because if you're just trying to look at the stack trace and you don't know what happened that led to that, it's really tough. So Honeybadger can really save you a bunch of time. I think that is one of my favorite features that they offer. And, you know, like we've said before, they have check-in monitoring. So if you've got cron jobs or like regular scheduled background jobs or anything like that, you can have those check in with Honeybadger and make sure that they're running, so you can feel confident that, yes, your cron jobs actually are running. So that's it. I just wanted to give them a shout out. We love Honeybadger, and they've been a long, long time supporter of everyone in the Rails community, and they will continue to be. So check them out. They've got a generous free tier. There's really no reason not to use them.
I get a lot of questions from people who want like a hard rule. And I'm like, there is no hard rule, but they're like, but I need something to like figure this out, right? I need some way to tell. And it's like, honestly, number one, I mean, apart from the things that you said, which I think are really good, but it's also really experience. The more you do this, the more you see things, and the more you're like, oh yeah, I can see that this is a great place to make this dry because I've seen this other places, or yeah, you know, this isn't going to be a good reason because of this, and this. And this is also where YAKME kind of comes in, where like you really, a lot of the times I've abstracted code and I really didn't need it. I don't want to say it's a waste of time, but at the same time, it's not getting the company to where it needs to be if I'm wasting time being an artist with the code.
It's tough because it's hard to just say like, oh, just go do it 50 times and you'll figure it out for yourself. Because like that's unfair to a lot of right. people. Because it's also like, well, wait, is it 50? Is it 51? Will I learn the 52nd time? And that's like the crux of a lot of where I'm coming from here is just, yeah, like all these things are things that seem like they have really hard and fast rules and they're attractive for that reason. And they have value, but it's harder to tease out when to apply it and not.
Yeah. And that's why I don't like the term rule for a lot of programming things. It's more like a guideline.
Yeah, or best practice.
Like, you know, yeah, like this is an option. Yeah, it's a best practice. Like in the perfect world, then you can do this. But in reality, it's never that clean. And a lot of these good code guidelines kind of come out of an academic place. And it's very divorced from reality, honestly. And like for good reason, and there's really nothing we can do about it. But at the same time, you got to recognize that Sandy Mess's rules, for example, like work great in certain circumstances when your team is a certain way and you have all these certain factors going into it. But at the end of the day, I very rarely find that you can just plug and play some of these things because a lot of it kind of goes back to the team as well.
Yeah. And I mean, and in fairness to what we're dubbed as Sandy Metz's rules, she also has the zeroth rule, which is if you can convince your partner or your pair or the rest of the team to ignore or overrule the rule, then do so.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about performance? Let's say I've got my Scout dashboard up here, or my Datadog or whoever wants to pay us. Let's say we got that measure up and I'm looking at it and I'm like, oh, well, we've got, you know, this area is fast and this area is not. What if I use that as a metric of like how our application's doing?
So you're already ahead of the game for some number of people because you're tracking that. So you have some way to recognize that. And then we talked about business value earlier. If one endpoint shows up in that graph, you're looking at like 95th percentiles. And if you have a list of things that are ordered, one of them is going to be first and one of them is going to be last. And should you be continuously pulling from the last one and saying, let's make this one faster? Maybe, but how much faster do you want to make it? Why do you want to make it faster? And what is that going to do for your application or your business? You need to be able to answer those questions before you just say like, oh, I'm always just going to pull from the bottom of the stack and just be continually pushing myself forward to make the most performant app ever.
Yeah. I mean, a rule that I tend to do is it on the critical path? Is this like on the way to us getting paid? If it is, then that's something like, yeah, I would want to focus on more. And again, it does go back to what is the business value? Once again, it depends. In all of these things, though, the very important underlying point is that you have to communicate with your team, with the business, with the product managers, whomever. And it has to be like an open conversation. And if you just start going off and doing things, like you're going to make mistakes or waste time and someone may be upset with you. But if these are all communicated and discussed and everyone's kind of aware and on board, I think that's really the place you want to be.
Yeah. And even if, so let's say there is something that doesn't have the greatest performance and it would be really swell and very important if we did make it more performant. Then there's the question of how do we do that? And any of those methods for any of those things are also going to have costs. Oh, so we can add a CDN or we can cache all this stuff and we can do all that. And that's great. We've got to pay for those things, which, may not be a big deal. It may be a big deal. So you've got to make that case back to people. Then you've got caching. So now you've got another problem, caching, right? You've got to manage the complexity that you've introduced by having that performance. And it may be warranted and called for, and that's great, but you've got to be able to make that call, and that's harder to do sometimes. You can also make changes in service of performance that negatively impact the readability of the code, the likelihood that it can change easily, and that your team can support it. Oh, so this part of my application is a hotspot. It gets hit all the time and its performance could be increased by that. Okay, I'm going to write a C extension that makes this super fast. That may be absolutely what you need to do. Probably very little of the time. And also, that may mean that if you're the only person at the company that can also write C, I hope you never take vacation or you train up your team to know how to do that and how to take care of that. Because now it's harder for anyone else who like, oh, we're just a bunch of Rubyists to then go, oh yeah, just hope that part never breaks. And even in Ruby, right? You can write Ruby in certain ways that are a bit more cryptic or difficult to understand. And it could be for very good performance reasons, but you need to weigh that against how do we explain that? How do we teach that across the team? And how do we still provide affordances such that it can, one, be understood, and then two, changed and maintained over time?
Yeah, especially if you write some C extensions and then you go get another job. That's the worst. I have thoughts and opinions on that. But the same could be said about dropping into ARHEL, for instance. Like if you have a team full of younger developers and you're all over here dropping into ARHEL all the time, it's, what are you doing? You have to keep in mind, like the team, when you're writing this code, is this the type of code that my team can maintain and understand? And is there something I can do to increase that? And not shirking that responsibility, because it is your responsibility if you write that code.
Absolutely. Yeah. The other tricky thing with performance is sometimes you can write code that like you believe to be more performant and has been demonstrated in other places is more performant. And then it turns out in your case, it isn't. So it's not enough to just like do the change. You also need to prove that the change actually worked through benchmarking or rolling it out in a very considered, thoughtful way, perhaps with like feature flags or like X percentage of traffic and whatnot to get a read on, hey, yeah, so we did cache, like obviously caching is more performant, right? Well, if your cache expiration hits all the time or not often enough or is incredibly difficult to evict certain things, your site may actually be slower now. And you're paying more money for managing your cache and you have to manage the complexity of it. And that doesn't mean those things aren't overcome, but it's not enough to just go, we did it. We have caching. It's better now. Trust me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I've run into that where we thought we were being clever by caching something, but it was a list item and we didn't really think it through because there ended up being more churn around that code than we anticipated. So all of a sudden we're in this situation where we deploy and the changes aren't showing up because everything's cached and the only option is to blow away the cache. And now it's even worse, right? Now you've just done like this oopsie.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile to do that work. It's just, right. It's harder than just saying, yeah, we did it.
Right. Yeah. I definitely agree that, you know, benchmarking, however you decide to measure it, but like measuring before and after so that you can prove that it's better and maintainable and things like that, it's very important.
Yeah. And also that's interesting and hard too, right? So like, then you also need to put your like your benchmarking itself under a microscope. Oh yeah, this benchmarked as better off on my machine on my local database. And then when I unleashed it on a million rows, it just completely nosedived. But it was blazingly fast and so much faster when there were 10.
Right. Yeah. So weird. Yeah, that's a great point as well. So what are some other things when it kind of comes to measuring good code, quote unquote?
Lean on your team, lean on your peers. And that can be hard too, because like, I don't know, like I have a lot of bad ideas. So like sometimes people ask me things like, yeah. And the only bad news is I have a microphone right now.
Right.
But if you're in a team and you need to be considerate of what the norms are, not just like to fit in, but to make sure that you're making code in ways that services their ability to be effective and efficient members of the team as well. And that's something that's, if there's a metric for it, I'd love to hear about it. But being a good teammate is a hard one to codify. But if there are certain things that like the team values, make sure that we're even either reevaluating those things or that we're like serving the needs of the team by doing those things.
Well, some of those examples or things like that are things that you can put into your CI/CD.
Sure.
Like RuboCop or, you know, whatever you use. So I think also finding ways to like, this is my opinion. I've had many people disagree with this, but I try to remove the human as much as possible because that's just how I am. But finding ways to like keep something measured or keep something from happening without a human having to intervene. If it is the string thing, how do we make sure that everyone on the team is following this guideline without someone having to catch it every time in code review?
Use standard RB.
Yes. Plus one, but not the point. Is there anything else around this topic that you wanted to go into?
Earlier on, you mentioned that you said you think there are very few metrics that you find valuable. Is that number zero, or what are the metrics that you like?
It depends. It really does depend on the team and how you work. Because for me, something that I like is, because I work on a team where we do sprints and we have points and things like that. And at the end of the quarter, I'm expected to hit a certain amount of story points. I think that's a pretty fair metric. My boss is also very against the whole like taking like a number, like lines of code committed, for example, I think is a good one. He's very against that idea because he's, you know, a great boss. He's, you know, that's not how you measure a developer, by the lines of code you commit. So I think it'd be easier to list off the bad ones, honestly. But there's a lot of things that you can't measure as well that are, I think, very important. I'm trying to think of some specific ones. How much code review are you doing, for instance, if that's one of your goals or one of your responsibilities on a team? And maybe if you're responsible for doing tickets and stuff like that, how many of those are you doing? And, you know, what do your peers say about you? Because at the end of the day, you can bang out code all day, but if you're an asshole, then you're not contributing really that much to the team. So I can't think of, there's really not a lot, but it hammers down to like, what are your responsibilities? What does the business care about? And how are you pushing the business forward? Anytime it comes to counting like something in the code base, that's generally a smell, like lines of codes committed, amount of coverage, the amount of tests you added, things like that. Yeah, blah. What about you, Jason, Chris?
I'm with you on that. I also am a little bit, I just work by myself and I am the developer side and the business side. So to me, it's always just like, my goal is keep it as simple as possible so I can continue maintaining it and just make sure it's valuable. So people need to use it if it's open source or needs to sell if it makes money. And the revenue is kind of my metrics, or issues and support tickets. If things are unreliable, a very good example is the PageM that I'm rewriting. There's a few like choices in there that were like, seemed good at the time. And now they show their fragility in basically, I have a gem that requires you to add fields to the user model. And then if I ever need to change that, you've got to also add more migrations. And it would just be easier, like Rails does, to extract a model that the gem maintains and put everything there and use associations instead. And that was one of those measurements where I was like you were saying earlier about the, if it happens three times kind of thing, pay attention to it. And it happened way more than three times in the GitHub issues. And I was like, all right, I need to fix this because that's not a good experience for people. And I also don't want to just every time copy paste the same message and say, hey, you missed the new migration, because I'd rather just have the software work better. But I'm obviously a one-man band, but I've worked on teams in the past to try to do keep track of velocity on Pivotal Labs, on our feature shipping and stuff. And it's hard because they're all, some of them matter more than others. And so, you know, we could be shipping a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't really matter because they're easy to do versus shipping something important. And how do you balance that? Because you probably need to do some of both. And I found them all very kind of hard to do as well.
Well, I was real excited for what I was going to say until you killed it just now. We've actually started doing some code coverage stuff at Podia like within the last week. But to be blatant, I haven't really looked at it because like I'm writing specs for my features and like stuff I'm adding. And so that may change over time. It's still pretty new. But one thing that I've been trying to do differently, it's like a personal metric. It's not really with the code, but it's just about shipping smaller things, because I'm really bad about, oh, here's like my first ever PR at Podio. It's like, oh, here's 80 files changed that adds this huge feature that's really critical. And this last feature I worked on is pretty small, but I have 14 pull requests for it. But that's, to like Chris's point, it's not a good metric because you could be shipping a lot of small stuff that doesn't matter. But it is, for me, a good metric because if I am actually like shipping stuff that matters, I'm doing it in a way that I'm not going to take the whole app down, hopefully, with like one merge.
And I think you have the context on that metric for yourself, which is good. Because if you blanket that metric to everybody on the team, they're not going to all interpret that the same way that you do. And I think that is probably the hardest part of all the metrics in general, is just the interpretation of it matters so much.
Well, yeah, because we also like, we pair at work. Two people, they may rotate half a day. You should probably combine their output for that. And it's like, there's a lot to keep up with there.
One thing that you made me think of is that, and I've said this before too, it's a lot of the times adding in all these gems to measure all these things, at the end of the day, no one really ends up using them. They kind of just sit there and take up space. So if you are going to measure things like code coverage or performance or velocity or things like that, someone has to be in charge of that metric, of keeping track of it, of like owning it, or however your team decides to do it. But if it's just there, like I add in Simple Cov and Jason, Chris, and I are all working on a Rails app, then if none of us are like in charge of making sure that we're doing that, then it's just going to be unused.
Yeah. And one point on a side project I had started years ago, I just didn't write very good specs. What I'm actually trying to say is I didn't write any specs. And so I use SimpleCov, start building up confidence that like I'm covering the code base. But once I got to like 80, 90%, it was like, okay, like you have done your job for me. Thank you. Like the Marie Kondo. Thank you. Thank you for what you've done. And I sailed it away.
Yeah, that is something that's crossed my mind as I've been refactoring pay, because there's so much surface area with, especially because Stripe works completely different from Braintree, and both of those are very different from Paddle, and all of the webhooks are totally different, and some features work with one and they don't with the other. And I've been writing all these tests, but I actually don't know if I'm covering everything. And that's been a concern. And that's one of those examples where I'm like, having some rough idea of where I'm at, especially if we need to go change something major, is helpful to know, just because there is so much to worry about, so many details, and all that context can't really live in the code or the test necessarily. And so having something like that, I've thought about, it probably needs that to give me a good idea of where I'm at. I don't really want to worry about it all the time, but I do want to make sure that, yeah, it doesn't run the suite and be like, yep, you got 25% coverage. And I'm like, wait a minute, I missed this whole thing or whatever. I think it would be very helpful for me to have better context on a big project like that, that is very complex. But I definitely don't ever want to be like, oh, coverage can never go down. We'll never merge a PR without that. I don't want it to be strict. I want it to be just a signal of here's what's happening.
Yeah. And I think what's huge with all these examples is they've been great exemplars of like being intentional about it. Jason's example of like, I had no coverage and then I saw like, started working on the treadmill and getting up there, and like, it made me feel jazzed about it. But then like, it served its purpose. And like, I had an actual like intentional moment where I was like, I don't need you anymore. And that's awesome, because then you're not like continually just like answering to that number. You've gone a step further and go like, what does this number mean for me right now? And what is it doing for me? And what is it not doing for me? And is it worth its weight? That's awesome.
Well, Kevin, where can people find you online if they want to keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm at Kevin_J_M on Twitter. If you're not a Twitter person, I also have a website at kevinjmurphy.com, and you can find other ways to find me there.
Sweet. We can keep track of the number of tweets he's posting to make sure that, you know, he's on a regular cadence and everything. That's the metric.
Make sure his velocity is good.
I'll also say, if you're doing a virtual regional meetup and you're looking for speakers, reach out to me if you'd like to have me chat. I'm very thankful for all the work that people that organize meetups do. It is largely thankless work, and they do a lot of it. And especially over the last year and a half, people have had to be very inventive in the work that they do. So if there's any way I can help out any of those groups, let me know. I'm happy to do so.
Awesome.
Love it.
Well, this was good. I enjoyed this. And on a podcast note, it's good to be back together, just talking Ruby, talking code. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you all for having me.